But let's talk about Larry Brown. I was reading this little booklet called A Late Start. And I guess what this means is that you got a late start as a writer. Why? Yeah. Why did you get a late start?
Well, I probably didn't start, you know, as early in life as most writers do. I was like 29 before I started. It just kind of hit me one day to finally try it. I had been thinking about trying to write for a long time, and I finally just decided to undertake it about 9 years ago. I'd been a reader all my life, you know, always loved books and reading. And I'd been wondering about how people taught themselves how to write, and I decided I would just finally try to start learning how.
You grew up in a working class household, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What did your family do?
Well, I've been a firefighter for about 16 years. My father did all kind of different jobs, you know, when I was growing up. You know, I'm from a, like I said, a working class background. He farmed early on when I was born, when I was real small. That's what he was doing when I was born.
Is the term a migrant worker? The characters in Dirty Work certainly worked in the fields. How do you describe them, as migrants or what?
Well, he was sharecropping when I was born, which is where you hire on to work for a man and, use his land, and he furnishes the tools, the equipment, fertilizer, and seed, and all that. And you repay him with part of the crop.
Mm-hmm. You grew up a good portion of your life in Memphis, didn't you?
Yeah, I lived there for about 10 years, from the time I was 3 to 13.
Mm-hmm. Did you do a lot of reading when you were young?
Yeah, I did quite a bit. I started reading, you know, pretty prodigiously when I was small, and I always kept it up, you know, all my life.
When you graduated from high school, if I read some of the publicity material, it didn't occur to you at that time to go on to a higher education, did it?
No, it didn't really. About the only thing I was concerned with was just getting out and getting me a job and buying myself a car. I wanted to have a way to go. I didn't have anywhere to go. And I knew I couldn't have one until I went to work. So I didn't really have any interest in any higher education, you know. I was mainly concerned with just getting out of school, getting through with it, getting finished with it.
Now, in Dirty Work, the two protagonists of the book are Vietnam veterans. You served in Vietnam, didn't you?
No, I never did serve in Vietnam. I was in the Marine Corps from 70 to 72, but I never did go to Vietnam.
What kind of duty did you have in the Marine Corps?
I stayed at Camp Lejeune for about half the time in a guard company there. And then I was at Marine Barracks, Philadelphia, for about 13 months, where I finished my tour at.
And where?
At Marine Barracks, Philadelphia.
Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that sounds like an easy military career.
Yeah, it wasn't too bad.
How did you get into the Marine Corps? Did you enlist?
Yeah, I enlisted back when the draft was going on. You know, they had the lottery system, and they pulled everybody's birthday out one at a time, you know, 365 dates out of the year. Well, July 9th is my birthday, and that year they pulled it out number one. And so I had already been classified. I was 1A, and I knew I was going. So I just decided to join the Marines. You know, I knew I wouldn't have any choice if the Army drafted me. So I went ahead and joined the Marines while I still had a choice to pick what branch of the service I wanted to go into.
Why the Marines?
Well, I just, I guess I wanted to see if I could make it. They seemed like the toughest thing going, and I wanted to be in the best, you know.
What happened after your 2 years in the Marines?
Well, I came back to Oxford. I went back to a job I had at a factory there in town, and about a year later, I got on at the fire department, where I've been working ever since. I got on there in 73, and I married, raised a family, and then about 1980, I started trying to write, you know, seriously.
What took you to Oxford?
Well, Oxford is about is only about 10 miles away from where I was raised. Oxford's where I was born, and that's where all my family are. It's home, you know, my home.
There's a fairly large literary shadow over Oxford, isn't there?
Yeah, Faulkner.
In addition to your own, I mean.
Well, I don't know how big mine is so far, but yeah, there's a big you know, literary heritage there because of Faulkner and the university and all that. You know, where's several writers who live in town there who are well known. Barry Hannon and Willie Morris both live there.
So you joined the fire department, and obviously, you say you joined the fire department. It's not a volunteer fire department.
No, it's a professional,
paid
department.
And what was it like? What has it been like for you on the fire department, especially since you are spending a great portion of your time writing? I mean, do you get razzed by the other firemen or what?
No, I think they're pretty, you know, happy with what I've done. You know, I brought some recognition to my department, you know, with my work and everything. I've had a pretty good bit of publicity about it, and they're happy to see me succeeding with my work because I've been doing it for so long. You know, they've been knowing about it for a long time, so they're glad to see me succeeding.
You're a captain, though.
Mm-hmm.
Now. They can't really razz you very much if you're.
No, they can't say too much.
Well, so about 8 or 9 years ago, you started testing the waters in mm-hmm. terms of writing. You had no experience, no formal training. Of course, it is stated that it's almost impossible to teach anybody writing, that a writer has to learn it himself in some form. But you wanted to write, so tell me about your first effort.
Well, the first thing I wrote was a novel about a man-eating grizzly bear in Yellowstone National Park. This is God's honest truth. I'd never been to Yellowstone National Park, and I wrote this terrible, terrible novel, and I thought it was good, and it would be published, you know, and I sent it off up here to New York, you know, and got my first rejection slip. You know, it took me about 5 months to write that novel. It was like 327 single space pages. I didn't even know you were supposed to double space back then. I mean, it was terrible, and I was crushed. You know, I was crushed when it came back, you know, that they didn't publish it. But that was just kind of the tip of the iceberg. I decided, you know, well, maybe I don't know enough to get one published. I'll write another one. And so I started another one, and I started writing some short stories. And then after about 2 years, it dawned on me, you know, this is going to be a lot longer haul than you figured on when you started out. But I just kept going. I had the belief that if I stayed at it long enough, I would eventually learn how to do it right.
So what was this process? You stayed at it long enough, but when you finished a story, you looked at it. It's kind of difficult to appraise your own work, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. When you start out, you don't have any objectivity at all. That's one of the hardest things to gain is some objectivity about your own work. You're jaded by what you write yourself, and you don't really hold it up to what you admire, or I didn't, you know, when I was starting out. And that was really one reason that I started reading more and more literature and found out what it meant, you know, to read literature and how hard it was to write literature. So writing helped me become a better reader because I started reading better and better writers. I started reading the best writers I could find, you know, contemporary literature. Stuff was being published, you know, now. So it's just a long, slow process for me, a combination of reading and writing both.
Some teachers of creative writing often suggest to their students that they find an author they like and try to imitate that author or that style. Did you try that approach at all?
Yeah, I used to try to imitate William Faulkner. You know, I thought that was the way to go back then. But I found out that that's not it. You've got to write in your own style. You've got to find your own voice and your own way of telling stories, you know. And that's what probably everybody who is trying to learn how to write is searching for, is his own voice, how to be unique, you know.
Does he search for his own voice, or does he just settle into a pattern that emerges as his own voice?
Well, I don't know. Some people may. I try not to do the same way, you know, the same thing each time. I try to be different with a piece of work. I like to experiment with the language and try and write in new forms occasionally. You know, I like to mess around with the language all I can and not be stuck in just one particular pattern.
Well, you kept writing these short stories, and finally you got one published, didn't you?
Yeah, I got one published in 82 in Easy Riders magazine, a motorcycle magazine in Malibu, California. And I thought I had it made then, you know. I thought I'd broken through and I would sell everything else thereafter, you know. But that wasn't the case. It was about 2 more years before I placed another store. And I was writing, you know, just all the time. I think I wrote 39 short stories in 1983. None of them were published, you know. I was writing.
What did you do? Just send these out to various magazines?
Yeah, I sent them everywhere. I kept stories out, you know, 10 or 12 at a time, all the time, you know, everywhere.
You mean you grouped them?
No,
you
know,
them out to a single publication?
No, one to each different magazine. I would send 10 or 12 out at a time, but, you know, to 10 or 12 different magazines, yeah.
And it all come back.
It all come back, yeah.
Well, I was talking to the short story writer Bobby Ann Mason, with whom you may have something in common to a degree, because her last novel was In Country, which has been filmed also about Vietnam. And she was telling me, she was sitting right where you are just a few months ago, and she was saying that even to this day, the majority of her stories are rejected. One out of every dozen stories she sends off to the New Yorker. She has success with the New Yorker, but they'll turn down a dozen for every one. So she says her approach is this. She says, one, don't get discouraged, and two, have a ample supply of postage and envelopes.
Yeah.
And she just keeps sending them out to the Southern Review and to various magazines. And she says eventually... it might take a couple of years, but eventually most of her stories have found a home.
Yeah, I agree with that. If you believe in a piece of your own work strong enough, you know, it doesn't matter how many rejection slips it collects. To me, it just means that the right person hadn't seen it yet. And I don't let that discourage me.
Well, you finally got a number of short stories published. They were collected into a book, weren't they? Tell me about that.
Yeah, that was my first book I published last year called Facing the Music. And I wrote most of those probably in about a 3 or 4 year period from about 1985 through, or say late 1984 through early 1988. And many of them had been rejected many times. One story in that collection had been rejected 15 times. But all of them, you know, I felt good about all of them, the ones that I wanted to put together for this book. When Shannon Ravenel first contacted me about trying to put one together, she asked if I had enough stories to publish in a collection. I said, yeah, I've got about 100, you know, how many do you want to see? But I was kind of just kidding. I said, I've really only got probably about 10 or 15 that would be good enough to publish. And from that group, we came up with this collection of stories.
I assume that the story you sent to Easy Writer magazine, was that the name of the magazine?
Mm-hmm.
That was not in the collection?
No, it was not in there.
Well, now we're almost up to date with Dirty Work. This is your new novel, published by this wonderful little publishing house called Algonquin Books, and they have so much interesting literature that they send up, and I know they have a contract recently to distribute their books through the Workman Press, which was a good thing for them. Tell me how Dirty Work developed as a book.
Well, I built a new house in 1986. I took about 6 months off from writing anything at all to build this house. And I moved to it in August of 86, and I moved a table into my dining room, and I sat down the first day. I was in that house, and I started writing a story about a guy who had come back from Vietnam, and he stayed in his room all the time. He wouldn't go out and see anybody. He didn't want, his face was all messed up, you know, from shrapnel damage, and all. He didn't want anybody to see him. So that's initially where I began Dirty Work, and I took it through about 3 drafts over the next probably year and a half. And in the meantime, now we put this first collection together. But after the collection was published, and I had the third draft ready, I showed it to Shannon Ravenel, my editor. And I started working on it even harder. And we sent, you know, pages back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And I started working on the story more, refining it more, and carried it through about 2 more complete drafts. And by the time I wound up with it, I had thrown away about 600 pages, you know, besides what appears in the book. And the whole process of writing took me about 2.5 years.
Yeah, you kept the narrative very tight. But one good thing you had with Shannon Ravenol, you weren't working in a vacuum. You did have some help.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so you got a different perspective as you
wrote. Yeah. You know, it's a lot better to have her working with me than to just be by myself, because she's got her own objectivity about it, and you know, she's just a wonderful editor, and she cares so much about the work, and she wants it to be as good as it possibly can, and she can point out to me my mistakes, you know, in a constructive way that helps me see what I need to work on harder and what I need to strengthen, what I need to de-emphasize or whatever, you know. And it's not an easy process, you know. We had arguments, you know, about certain things in there. But we were both working toward having a good novel, you know, a novel that I could finally publish, because I had written 5 others before this one. You know, none of them had been published. And so, you know, this was just kind of like the culmination of all the years I had spent, you know, trying to learn how to do this. And so she helped me finally put this book together.
Well, let's hope it's not the culmination.
Well,
let's hope you have many more books in you. When you write, some teachers say, forget grammar, forget spelling, forget punctuation, just get the story on. Was this your approach?
Yeah, that's my idea. You know, there's a lot of stuff in there that's not grammatically correct, just the way Braden talks, or the black character in there. I like to go with dialogue, the way it sounds in the ear, rather than, you know, how it's supposed to be on the page. I want to write it so that the reader hears it in his ear, like somebody would, how it would sound coming out of somebody's mouth.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's why I like to write dialogue that way, too, because you're not bound to any grammatical rules.
Right. You can do anything you want to with it that way. Mm-hmm.
Now, here is the story of 2 Vietnam veterans, both in the hospital, one without legs and arms, the other with a shattered face and mental problems because of the bullet that hit him, for which he was treated in the Philippines. Such a sad story. Did you know how it was going to come out at the end?
Yeah, I had an idea. You know, I had a pretty positive idea of how it had to end as I was going through it, you know. One of these characters was kind of modeled after a guy that I knew when I was in the Marine Corps. Now, of course, Braden, you know, he came along later. I originally started the novel about the guy who stayed in his room all the time, but Braden came along much later. But eventually, through writing the story, you know, writing it over and over, I figured out what, you know, how everything was eventually going to turn out, and that's usually the way I work. I don't often know what I'm trying to say when I start writing it, but by writing it and refining it, I find out what I'm going to do with it. I can never, you know, finish anything in one draft. I usually revise quite a bit.
Well, you have wonderful reviews. You sent a lot of these up there, a lot of interesting articles. I guess you're quite a celebrity now in Oxford, huh?
Well, I don't know. They're pretty excited about being on the Today Show tomorrow.
Were you on the Today Show?
Tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow morning. Tomorrow morning.
They're all up in the air about that. Yeah.
Everybody. Are you nervous?
Not too bad, I don't think. I don't think I'm too bad over it. You know?
That's all right. They're only going to give you 2.5 minutes.
Yeah. It can't be too painful. Yeah.
They're not. They never really talk about the art of writing anyway. I mean, they'll probably ask you about your career as a fireman,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fire captain,
yeah.
And how do you reconcile writing and how do you reconcile writing and being a fire captain? But I guess you work shifts, don't you?
Yeah, I work a shift. I work 24 on, 48 off. I don't mix the two. You know, I work when I'm at home, and that's the only time I work. Usually, when I'm on duty, if I'm not doing anything, if we don't have a fire going or some training or something, I sit there and read. And that's where I catch up on all my reading. That's what I'm on duty.
But you might go all day without a fire, right?
Yeah.
A 10-hour
yeah.
shift?
Mm-hmm.
Why can't you do some writing there, or would they frown on it?
No, they wouldn't frown on it. It's usually that there's too much noise going on, card game, television, or somebody hollering at somebody or something. I work with some kind of wild boys, you know. It's kind of noise around there sometimes.
You've been making some appearances at literary conferences, haven't you? What's that like for you?
Well, it's real nice, you know. It's nice to get up in front of people and read my work and hear them applaud. And it's a really, really good feeling to take what I've been doing, you know, on the page and get up and read it and have people appreciate it. It's a great feeling. It really is.
Are you at the point now where you're sharing notes and comments with other writers about the craft?
Well, I'm beginning to have quite a few younger writers asking me for help, you know, through the mail. And I'm trying to help them, you know, when I can, you know, when I think they deserve some help, you know. I mean, I try to be honest with them and tell them, you know, well, this is good or this is not good or you need to do better, you know. I know what I went through looking for help when I was starting out, you know, and people were very generous to me, people with their time. And so I'm trying to help them, you know, as much as I can, too.
A lot of criticism, for example, rejection of stories or rejection of novels is simply an opinion, someone's opinion. It doesn't mean too much. I mean, the tales are myriad of stories that have been turned down over and over and over, and they'll pop up and they'll become a critical success or even a bestseller. It happens all the time.
Yeah, it's pretty common. It sure is.
Did you read Sophie's Choice by William Styron?
No, I haven't read that one. Sure.
Well, you ought to read that because there's a section in that book at the beginning where Styron had come to New York from his native Virginia and was working at McGraw-Hill, which then occupied an ugly green office building on West 42nd Street, very close to the river. They're now on 6th Avenue. And it was a publishing house, and still is to a degree, which was very conservative. And people always wore suits and ties, and Styron wasn't really like that. And but he was an editor there, and one day a manuscript came in, and he looked at this book. He was giving them trouble anyway because he was kind of a maverick. He would always come in carrying the New York Post, which was then a very left-wing newspaper. So this manuscript came in, and he said, "This is awful." He wrote a critique. He said, "This is terrible. This is about a bunch of Norwegians sailing the Pacific on a raft." He said, "This has absolutely no interest in anybody." Well, the manuscript went to another publishing house and turned out to be Thor Heyerdahl's Kon-Tiki, which was a worldwide bestseller. And finally, McGraw-Hill said, "Enough, Styron, enough," and they let him go. But, I mean, even Styron's opinion about this manuscript was an opinion, and somebody else picked it up and made a bestseller out of it.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of the... There's so many things you don't have any control over, even if you... are writing, you know, on a competent level, even if you have a good story, you can always send it off and have the wrong person see it, a person in power, a person who has the right to accept it or reject it, and just because that person doesn't agree with it that particular day, you know, he sends it back home, and it's hard then, and that's what makes you uncertain, and that's one of the scariest things about it when you're starting out, you know, you've got to have somebody else reinforce your opinion that your work is good. You know, I mean, I had that happen to me, you know, several times. But there's really not much you can do about it. Just if you believe in it, keep sending it out. Keep sending it out.
So I guess your advice to struggling writers is try not to get discouraged and keep sending them out, huh?
Yeah. Just keep on. You know, if you believe in yourself and you want to apply yourself hard enough, you know, I think anything is possible.
Well, Larry Brown, Dirty Work, it's a beautifully done novel. I am sure it's not going to be the last one. Congratulations.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.